This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. A controversial natural gas pipeline proposed for southern New Hampshire will not move forward. The company behind the Northeast Energy Direct pipeline plan says it's suspending efforts to connect New England to the shale gas fields of Pennsylvania. Pipeline opponent Marianne Harper told WMUR-TV she's pleased by the news, but says this story isn't over yet.
There's still an application before the FERC for a 30-inch diameter pipeline. When that application is withdrawn, then I think we can feel confident that this project and this configuration is gone.
This week, the New Hampshire House approved an additional $5 million to deal with the opioid crisis. The House rejected funding for a program designed to teach substance abuse prevention in schools. Democrat Mary Cooney of Plymouth argued that was the wrong move.
We already know that we cannot arrest or treat our way out of this epidemic. The most cost-effective way to deal with it is prevention.
And New Hampshire U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen is among those cheering the news that Harriet Tubman will replace Andrew Jackson on the front of the $20 bill. Shaheen made several attempts last year to get a woman on the front of U.S. currency.
I think she's a great choice because of her fight for equality and freedom. It really embodies the American spirit, and I think she deserves to be featured alongside our founding fathers.
It's our weekly news roundup on The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our guest for the hour, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital. Dean, great to have you.
Good morning, Brady.
Trent Spinner is with us, executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Good morning, Trent.
Thanks for having me.
And Casey McDermott, digital reporter for NHPR. Hi there.
Good morning, Brady.
Now, let's start with the news that Kinder Morgan has suspended its plans to build a natural gas pipeline that would have crossed through southern New Hampshire. Joining us now to talk about that is NHPR Sam Evans-Brown, who has covered this project from the beginning. Hi there.
Glad to be here, Brady.
Now, this announcement came out kind of at the end of the day on Wednesday, if I remember right. Was this a surprise?
I think it was a huge surprise. I mean, a lot of people are, of course, we're not privy to the boardroom discussions where these decisions are made, and there really was no indication that they were going to pull the plug on the project. They seemed to be going full bore ahead. They had their application in with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They had their application in with the State Siting Board. Seemed like they were going full steam. The only troubling sign one could have pointed to is the fact that the contracts that they had signed up for buying gas over the line were well below what they said they needed to proceed, but you know, that didn't seem to be slowing them down. So it wasn't raising many red flags for a lot of us, I think.
And these kinds of proposals don't exactly move quickly, and so it wasn't as if there was an obvious roadblock necessarily. But you mentioned about the contract. Was that the official explanation then?
That's exactly what they said. I mean, to throw some numbers out here, they said they had 620 some odd decatherms per day of people signed up. About a sixth of that was the local natural gas utility here in New Hampshire. Liberty Utilities was a big customer of this line. And they had said they needed at least $800,000 to proceed, but that they wanted to go forward with, 1.2 million or up up to 2.2 million decatherms. So we're talking, you know, they were at half of what they ideally had wanted to make the project pencil out. And I think that that's really probably was the nail in the coffin. They just couldn't get enough customers.
Now, when this project was first proposed, you could have easily seen that kind of volume going through because we were in a very different situation energy-wise than we are today.
Well, and what really is going on here is that they were counting on signing up natural gas fired power plants as customers, and the gas fired power plants have really been hesitant to pen these long term, you know, 20-year contracts for pipeline capacity because they just don't. I mean, the energy markets, especially on the electric side, are so volatile. They're just not sure that they can pay for those over the course of 20 years. They don't know what the natural gas market's going to be like 20 years from now. And so they've been really hesitant to sign up versus the heating utilities who are a cost of service business model. They know they can just submit their costs to regulators and get it paid for.
Trent.
Another big challenge was obviously energy prices, right? If you fill up your gas tank or you pay your electric bill, you'll see that energy prices have really crashed. And this company needed high energy prices to make this worthwhile. And so the amount of money they would have needed to spend to not only build the pipeline, but also all of the regulatory issues that they had to deal with. That was another thing they were saying, was that there's really no uniform regulatory process to do what we're trying to do. And so it would have cost them a lot of money to sort of go through all the hoops that they would have needed to go through. And so between the low energy prices, the difficult regulatory environment, it was just too much for them. And they said it wasn't a fair use of our shareholder funds.
And one thing we've certainly learned from this whole process, Dean, if nothing else, that there are a lot of hoops to jump through when a proposal like this comes up.
Yeah, I think this whole thing is indicative of the challenges that exist in the current regulatory environment to get these kinds of big energy projects approved. You know, we have Northern Pass, which is still pushing forward with its application. We've had a number of controversy surrounding large-scale wind projects. You know, there are real sort of trade-offs here. We saw with this particular pipeline a redesign of the route. We saw a lot of towns mobilizing opposition to having the pipeline in their neighborhoods. We even saw, I think, the state legislature start talking about redefining eminent domain so that they would have to take the entire property, not just a piece of someone's property if they needed it. So, you know, it's just increasingly complex and difficult environment. A lot of opposition groups pressing as well. I mean, it sounds like there are legitimate issues here with contracts and energy prices, but it would have been a tough slog. Irrespective, as we're seeing now with Northern Pass.
I wanted to come back to something that Trent mentioned a moment ago, Sam, about the price of simply not making this a sustainable project for Kinder Morgan shareholders. And yet, the head of the Business and Industry Association, Jim Roach, said in an NHPR story this week that something still needs to be done about the high cost of energy in this state. So help me reconcile how energy prices can be too low to make a pipeline worth building, but also too high for businesses.
So both natural gas and electricity prices are incredibly volatile. And what he's really talking about was a situation in the previous three winters where you had these great big spikes in both the cost of natural gas and the price of electricity during the winter heating months, when there was a lot of issues with the pipelines being basically full to the brim of natural gas and no more being able to get through. But this winter was really quite warm, and we didn't see those same spikes, and so the ground shifts very quickly on these questions of price. I think that the Business and Industry Association is in particular worried that, you know, this winter is not indicative of trends in the future, and that you know, next winter we could be back in the same boat that we were in 2013, which very well may be the case. But you know, it's a tricky thing. Anyone who thinks that they can tell you what the price of any energy commodity will be next December is just lying to you.
And one thing about the BIA, Mr. Roach was on this very show on the Exchange earlier this month, and he was very clear to say that we don't specifically support this pipeline.
But he did say that he feels that there may be some pressure now going forward to approve, if not this project, then another project going forward. So what are some of the other potential projects that are being discussed or may go forward?
So there's two big ones, and the one that's furthest along is Access Northeast, which is a collaboration between Spectra, who's the pipeline developer, and National Grid and Eversource, which are two big electric utilities. And this one is specifically targeted to two power plant operators, and it's kind of a – it's an interesting project. It's a little bit of a hybrid. It includes both pipeline capacity and liquefied natural gas storage facilities. So it's a little different than the straight we're going to build a pipeline. It's also what they call a lift and replace. So they're digging up old pipeline and putting down a bigger pipeline. So it's not greenfield like the Northeast Energy Direct. So that's the one that's furthest along, and that right now is the contract for that, between Eversource and the pipeline is before the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission, and this is sort of a first of its kind proceeding where an electric utility is trying to buy space on this proposed natural gas pipeline, which has never been allowed before, and it should be a real fight.
Is it possible that we may see some of the same opposition mobilizing around these proposals as we saw against Northeast Energy Direct, or one that we continue to see against Northern Pass?
It is already mobile. The difference is that the opposition to these projects is very localized, and because the Access Northeast is entirely not in New Hampshire, the opposition in New Hampshire is fairly muted. It tends to be folks who live along the route who are most concerned about it. But you can go online. You can find those opposition groups. They sprouted up long ago. And indeed, New Hampshire Plan, the pipeline activist group, have raised concerns about this idea of electric customers paying for natural gas capacity. So they have their concerns about that process as well. So we likely haven't heard the last from them.
It's a fair bet that we haven't heard the last on any of these issues. That's NHPR Sam Evans-Brown. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reporter Sam Evans-Brown has been covering the latest news that Kinder Morgan has suspended plans for the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline. Today in The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at some of the top New Hampshire news stories of the week, and you can join us with your comments and questions. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Let's move now to the State House, where lawmakers have been working for this entire session, really, on a number of issues related to the opioid crisis. This week, Casey, lawmakers in the House authorizing $5 million additional dollars to deal with opioid abuse. Could you break that money down? What might the state use that money specifically for?
Yeah, so according to reporting from Paige Sutherland, my colleague that was over at the State House this week, the measure would spend about $3 million on treatment services and another $2 million on housing for people who are struggling with addiction. And it also includes some money to hire a state attorney to deal specifically with the drug crisis. And these are things that we've been hearing about for the last few months. The state, convened this task force to talk about opiate issues. These are a lot of the proposals that were included in there, either, specifically or in the conversations that came up during those meetings. So this is really just a continuation of kind of the policymaking discussions that have been going on for a while about how best to address this.
And we see some evidence in that, Trent, again, of the question of where do we put the priority? Do we try to put more prosecutors on the job, more police trying to deal with the drug dealing, the drug trafficking? Do we see more evidence on treatment, on prevention? And so those issues continue to come up.
Yeah, and you can see that there are real philosophical differences about the best way to deal with this. There are people who think education is the best way to deal with this. There are people who think that more law enforcement officers will be the best way to deal with this. And I think it's kind of a sign of the legislature that we have, which is, you have teachers, you have police officers, you have, retired folks, and you have young folks, and they all kind of bring their ideas together. And so I think that's what you're kind of seeing breaking down in both the House and the Senate.
And Dean, another example of that is the House's vote to reject a bill that would have put some funding into a particular prevention program in schools.
Yeah, I mean that was a program developed up at Plymouth State, I lost my train of thought here a second. It was the HOPE program, which is Plymouth State. It's a heroin and opiate prevention education. It was a specific program designed to bring opioid and heroin prevention and substance abuse to teach that in the schools. And the idea was to make money available for schools to bring this program in. But legislators did not want to target fund a specific program like that. So they ended up not approving that.
Another issue that came up this week in the House, Casey, was a bill relating to opioids and child abuse investigations. What would that do?
Yeah, so this actually would change kind of when DCYF is able to intervene if someone is using – if a parent is using drugs. Before, as I understand it, there was no language that allowed the state to proceed with a child abuse investigation or a case or something like that.
So there are certain criteria that have to be in place before that investigation starts.
And this basically makes drug addiction one of those criteria. Now, there was some concern from people who said, well, you know, there are people who – are addicted to drugs, but maybe they're looking to seek treatment, and we don't want to set up anything that would deter maybe, you know, mothers who are opiate addicted from seeking the treatment that they need or from continuing the treatment that they need because they're afraid that, you know, there would be some kind of intervention there. And that's actually a legitimate concern that I've heard from people in the medical community and others in the kind of drug prevention treatment world in my own reporting on the issue. So there is a carve out in this bill that, you know, if you're actively seeking treatment or in treatment, that there would be, you know, exceptions in those cases.
Here's what one of the backers of that measure said. This is Democrat Skip Berrien of Exeter, who said the bill would ensure that the Department of Children, Youth and Families, DCYF, can offer services before problems escalate. Let's hear what he said.
Currently, the Division of Children, Youth and Families has no legal basis for intervening with families with untreated substance abuse until a child has experienced gross neglect, physical or sexual abuse.
That was Democrat Skip Berrien of Exeter speaking about a bill that would allow the Department of Children, Youth and Family to begin child abuse investigations in some cases involving opioids and the opioid crisis. So this is something we come back to every time we talk about opioids. Trent, is how many different facets this touches and how many different people wind up being involved in trying to deal with it.
Well, that's right. And I think that people underestimate just how impacted children are in the state. I can tell you from Manchester, you talk to police officers there who walk into scenes where there are opioid addicted parents and the children are also addicted in some way, or they are being neglected because their parents are you know, using. And they come out of these homes in Manchester almost in tears. These are police officers who have been on the beat for 20, 30 years who have said this is, you know, some of the things that we're seeing here, these are the most terrible things that we've seen in our entire career. And, you know, and so I think that's part of what this bill was trying to do.
And the bill now heads back to the Senate, Dean.
Yeah, what I think is so interesting about this is we've really seen a ramping up of resources, comparatively speaking, over the last 6 to 9 months, almost a year now, since it became clear that this was really blowing up into a full-fledged crisis. And it's going to be very interesting to see if, in fact, this works. We'll know in a year or two when we see what the rates are in subsequent years, whether or not this additional money, the additional focus on treatment, kind of new roles for medical professionals, for first responders, police, et cetera, whether it's all going to make a difference. We don't know. You know, historically, you often associate these kinds of issues with economic dislocation. And people often say to me, I'm surprised to hear New Hampshire has such a big problem. The economy is doing well. Unemployment's under 3%. Why is there a problem? And this really apparently cuts across all kinds of socioeconomic demographics. And so I'm just really interested to see when we start getting data in the next year or two, you know, is all of this making a difference or do they need to do more or something different?
And Casey, you were looking at some of the numbers involved here.
Yeah. So the state does this kind of monthly drug monitoring initiative, and they've just started to make these reports public. It's basically a collection of data from a lot of like public health safety agencies, and it goes out to people in, you know, other agencies across the state just to kind of give everyone like a dashboard basically on a month-to-month basis of different kind of indicators around that. And based on those numbers, I didn't really see much of a change in the last 5-6 months. Some things are increasing just slightly, but it kind of fluctuates month to month in terms of like ER visits or treatment admissions or the amount of Narcan being or the number of times that EMS crews are dispensing Narcan. And at least over the last 5 months of data, now that's just a small slice of time, there wasn't really a kind of noticeable or significant change in any of those figures. Now, we're looking at a lot of proposals that haven't yet been implemented. So I think moving forward, that'll be really important to keep an eye on that.
This is the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. After a short break, we'll take a look at some more of the week's news from the New Hampshire State House, and we'll take your comments and questions. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at NHPR. This is the Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. The opioid crisis has been getting attention in the legislature, as has a number of other issues. We'll be digging into those in just a moment. But first, we invite you to join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests for the hour, Trent Spinner, executive editor for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News, Casey McDermott, digital reporter for NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of NH Political Capital. Just one more note before we move on to other news from the State House. Since we've been talking about opioids, we should also note the announcement this week, Trent, about the death of Jeffrey Pendleton. Remind us a little bit about his story and what authorities said this week about his death.
Jeff Pendleton was a homeless guy from the Nashua and Hudson area who was arrested on a pretty simple charge, and he was held on $100 cash bail. $100 cash bail, but because he was homeless, he could not make that bail and was at the Valley Street Jail awaiting trial. He died suddenly. He was well known among groups who think that this is an unfair way to treat poor people, and it was a big loss for them. And what we found out this week was that he died of a fentanyl overdose. The jail superintendent says that he's investigating. But here's what's really interesting. Both the judge in charge of all the circuit courts who kind of handle these cases and the jail superintendent say he should not have been there. This was a very small, I think it was a violation level offense. He was being held on $100 cash bail, and he should not have had to spend, I think he was going to have to spend a month in jail over $100. And both the jail superintendent and the head judge for the circuit courts said that should not happen here in New Hampshire.
This has been an issue ongoing for, and as you mentioned, a number of groups. And earlier this month, Morning Edition spoke to the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union in New Hampshire, Gilles Bissonnette, who said that jailing people with low bail means poor people serve sentences before they're found guilty. Here's what he said.
Jeff would have stayed in jail until his next court date, which would have been approximately 1 month. So he would have served 30 days in jail before he had any ability to even contest the charge that he was arrested for.
That's Gilles Bissonnette of the New Hampshire ACLU speaking to Morning Edition earlier this month. And Casey, this is another one of these issues like opioids. We haven't heard the last of this.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, actually. I just saw a notice this week that the Administrative Committee on Rules for the Court System of the State actually posted a public notice that they're going to be considering changes in kind of how they determine fines for people. So basically taking into account more someone's ability to pay for that fine before issuing that. So that's, I think, directly connected to what we're seeing here.
Let's take a look at some of the other news now from the New Hampshire State House of the week. Dean, the state Senate rejected a bill yesterday that would have decriminalized possession of up to a half ounce of marijuana. These bills seem to come up year in, year out, and they continue to be voted down.
Yeah, this is interesting. I think this is something the House has passed some form of decriminalization. And again, I should be clear, decrim or decriminalization is different than legalizing marijuana the way it is, say, in Colorado. Decrim just means if you get caught with a small amount, and there have been varying bills, varying sizes in different years, either an ounce or I think this bill was a half ounce. It's a much smaller infraction than if you were caught with it under the current law. And I think the House has passed something like seven out of eight years they've passed this. It's really a perennial issue, and the Senate keeps defeating it. This was defeated, I believe, basically party line 14-10. In the Senate. So back to the drawing board for people who want decriminalization or eventually legalization. We've talked before. There's a lot of public opinion data that shows that people in the state generally support some form of decrim or even legalization. And as you know, we do have medical marijuana now, and that's been very slow to be implemented. So first responders and police especially are not particularly happy with the idea of liberalizing the laws on this. So that's been part of the pushback.
And another one of the issues that came up in that debate again, Trent, was the opioid crisis, that there were lawmakers who were saying, this is a mixed message.
Well, that's exactly right. They said, we are in the middle of a massive emergency. We are doing everything we can to fight this opioid crisis. And now's not the right time to be sort of sending a dual message that it would be okay to use a little bit of marijuana, but it's definitely not okay to use heroin or fentanyl. So that was the argument that you heard, and that was the argument that won the day. The Senate has been the graveyard for these marijuana bills for years. Even though there is I wouldn't say widespread public support, but you say I would say there's a marginal amount of public support for some sort of legalization or decriminalization.
The polling I've seen is certainly a majority.
Majority. Yeah. But and so that kind of and you'll see that these bills pass out of the House, but in the Senate, they just have not been able to get the votes.
Let's move on to a substance that is not only legal, but it's sold at state-owned stores. The New Hampshire Senate also voted this week to change a policy, Casey, toward the State Liquor Commission. What's the thinking here behind, first of all, the original policy and then behind this vote to make a change?
Yeah, so under a provision that was in the state budget, the Liquor Commission was supposed to cut spending to offset any kind of revenue shortfalls that it faced. But this week they decided to not necessarily penalize the commission for those shortfalls. And based on the audio that you heard coming out of the Senate this week, you heard Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley saying that, we're going into the busy summer season. We need to make sure that these retail stores are kind of, on solid footing and prepared to do their job.
We have that clip here. Let's hear State Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley.
In particular, going into the busy summer season, we need to make sure that our liquor stores, our retail stores, are well prepared to do their job.
That's State Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley. And Casey, this is, to put it in context, of particular concern because people are worried the winter tourism season, mm-hmm. with the warmer winter, might not have brought in as many sales as it would have in a more typical year.
Well, there's that, but there's also the increased competition that the liquor stores are facing from those in neighboring states like Massachusetts. So I think that they're a little bit concerned that, are we going to continue to see some shortfalls as people turn elsewhere or maybe don't come across the border to New Hampshire anymore to buy their liquor?
Trent, senators also approved a bill this week to allow for residents to obtain state licenses that are compatible with the federal Real ID law. Remind us the meaning of that.
Where do you want me to start?
The ramifications.
This has been going on for a long time. First, I should say, if you have a passport, you don't need to listen to what I'm about to say. right now, the federal government has issued a waiver to New Hampshire, basically saying, it's okay that you don't have certain security pieces on your state driver's license, but at a certain point in time, we're going to revoke this waiver and you will not be able to use your driver's license to get on an airplane, to get into a federally secure facility like a nuclear power plant. And so the state has been working to try to push the federal government off a little bit, but also trying to give people people who don't have a philosophical issue with a real ID, giving them an option to basically opt in. There are people who are concerned that the federal government will have access. They will have access to your social security number, your photo, stuff that some people don't want the federal government to have access to. Anyway, there's a bill that was approved, and it will allow people to essentially opt in. So if you feel like you would like a real ID, you're going to be able to get that.
And that opt-in provision is interesting, Dean, because that could potentially create a situation where people don't realize they have to opt in, and then they show up at the airport one day and well, I guess you need to find a new way to get where you're going.
Yeah, I mean, part of it will really be driven by the state's ability to kind of make this explicable to people, because you have, you know, you'll have these three options of signing a waiver that you understand that your regular license is not suitable for flying or federal facilities, and you can leave off the various pieces of information that you want to leave off, or you can get this real ID, or you can apparently pay $30 and get one with an embedded high-tech chip for an added security feature. And so, you know, the argument is that some people who oppose this, and we're one of the few states who have really kind of held out on this issue. I think there's only four states left.
For a long time, it seemed like the state was hoping the federal government would back down.
This is like a classic libertarian Big Brother type of argument, and opponents believe that this giving people the option to opt in is really sort of the first step of a slippery slope to eventually the federal government winning out on this. But Governor Hassan has said she would sign it as kind of a compromise to give people the option if they want this. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when you could fly to Canada with a driver's license, and you can't do that anymore. You got to have a passport. So, you know, in the wake of 9/11 and other terrorist events around the country, we have had this big debate over, you know, privacy rights versus the need to have enhanced security measures at the federal level.
One more item from the State House this week before we move on. Casey, the Senate has approved a bill that backers call constitutional carry. And there have been a couple of proposals about firearms licensing and so forth in the state. So what would this particular bill do?
I actually lost my place on that. I'm going to pass to someone else.
I can jump in. What this would allow you to, if you have the right to own a gun, it would allow you to carry it, concealed or not concealed. And this passed the Senate 14-10. Here's the problem. It is going to get vetoed by the governor's office, and it has no chance of being overridden in probably either the House or the Senate.
She vetoed a similar bill last year.
Exactly. So I don't think they have the votes to override. But, you know, this is sort of a perennial issue that we've been seeing coming from Concord.
Yeah, and the people who support this say that, you know, right now it's kind of – you're up to sort of – it's up to the local law enforcement in your community to decide. You have to apply for a separate permit to carry the concealed weapon, and it's up to the chief of police or some other local official to decide whether or not you get to do that. And the argument for people who support doing away with that requirement is that it's you know, it's sort of – you're up to the – it's capricious. It's really up to the particular individual. And if you have a right to carry a gun open carry, you should automatically have a right to have a concealed one as well. But as Trent mentioned, given kind of the sort of the gun rights debate in the state and in the country, Governor Hassan will veto it.
Today on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at the top New Hampshire news stories of the week. And you're welcome to join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. There's been a lot of talk this week about an investigation into material allegedly containing asbestos and other dangerous materials related to real estate developer Brady Sullivan Properties. Joining us now with more on that story is NHPR's Jack Rodolico. Welcome.
Morning, Brady.
This is a story of two building complexes. There's one in Manchester and one in Lawrence, Massachusetts. So let's start with Mill West in Manchester. What had been going on there that kind of led to everything else?
So the backstory is that about this time last year, early May, Brady Sullivan, you know, this is a company that's developed a lot of these old mills into apartments, and, you know, they call them luxury lofts, these really very pretty apartments. So they hired a contractor to come in and do some work in this building. And this is a building where people were already living, and there was some empty commercial space down below. And they're going to convert it into more apartments down below. Okay, so they hired this contractor, and the contractor didn't have a permit from the city. They also didn't have the mandatory federal training on how to deal with lead paint. So the result was that they sandblasted this space where lead paint dust just filled the air, and it literally kind of enveloped the building. I mean, the tenants there described this cloud of dust that came into some of their apartments. So what happened next was essentially the federal government and the state and the city all stepped in. They shut down the work zone, and they found that the contractor hadn't done their job. And ultimately what they also found was that Brady Sullivan was not communicating to their tenants the way that they should be about the risk of lead, which is very dangerous, especially for children. So what happened was federal government came in, they cracked down, they fined the contractor, they forced Brady Sullivan to, you know, go in and clean up the apartments, which had already started. And now the tenants continue to battle Brady Sullivan and the contractor in court. There's a pretty big lawsuit with over about half the tenants in the building are suing both the tenant and the contractor right now, the landlord.
As that's going on, then there's this other allegation that some hazardous material from Millwest may have actually ended up at this other complex in Lawrence, the Pacific Mills Industrial Complex.
Right. So this is another complex. It's very similar to the mills that you would see in Manchester that is in the process of being converted to empty space and industrial space into residential apartments. And Brady Sullivan owns most of the buildings in the Pacific Mills complex. And so here's the thing, right? Everything that I told you before we know to be true. This is where it gets into the allegation territory, okay? So MassDEP got a tip last fall that said this was from a subcontractor that was presumably working in Lawrence or in Millwest. And they said, I know that construction debris was driven from Manchester down to Lawrence, 10 truckloads, and it was full of asbestos and lead. And it was buried in basement cement in one of these buildings owned by Brady Sullivan. Okay, so that's the allegation. So they tell DEP, go down there, and in this location, what you're going to find is more piles of this stuff outside the building where I know that they buried it in the basement. Sure enough, MassDEP goes unannounced and they find these piles. They test it immediately. There's a lot of asbestos in it, and the lead results didn't come back immediately, so we don't know. And this is all based on this chain of emails that NHPR acquired. So then what happens next is state and federal regulators all get on the line and they start emailing back and forth and they say, let's have a conference call. And a criminal investigator with EPA says, let's all get on the phone to talk about criminal and civil investigations of Brady Sullivan and Environmental Compliance Specialists Incorporated, which is that same subcontractor that didn't do the work right in Millwest. Okay, so we don't know. Brady Sullivan says that they didn't know about this stuff. ECSI, the subcontractor, I couldn't get them on the phone. I called them. It all went to voicemail. They haven't renewed their corporate filings in the state so far this year, so they don't appear to be actually functioning as a business in the state anymore. But there's a lot we don't know. We don't know if regulators went into the basement. We don't know if they have a conclusion of the investigation. We know that there is an ongoing investigation, both on the federal and state level in Mass. But we don't know the nature of that investigation. So we know that there was a strong suspicion that this stuff came from Millwest and that regulators were starting to ask questions in that direction, but we don't know what conclusions they have gotten to, if any, yet.
Trent, the investigators have not been commenting publicly, but the union leader got a statement from Brady Sullivan, and there were two things I noted. One was, and I'll just quote, it says, at this time, we are highly confident that Brady Sullivan has engaged in no wrongdoing or illegal activity at the Pacific Mills project. That's the complex in Lawrence, Mass. The report also notes that in the statement, Brady Sullivan says it talked with Massachusetts officials and said that it's not uncommon for rogue contractors to illegally dump materials. So I'm just curious what you've made of those statements.
I thought it was interesting. That was a very lawyerly statement that certainly planted some reasonable doubt, right? I mean, let's just be clear that taking asbestos across state lines, burying it in a basement, whoever does that, that would be very illegal. And there have been problems in Millwest. I have two friends who live there. One who says that it was very difficult to live there, and they actually ended up withholding rent and moving out, and they are part of the lawsuit. And then I have another two friends who live in another apartment who say, it really wasn't that bad. The company, Brady Sullivan, came in, cleaned it all up, and it wasn't that big of a deal. So I think there's a lot to be I think there's a lot left here. These emails don't really give you a sense of where the process stands. We talked to the EPA, and they said, we don't comment on ongoing investigations, which is important. That's an important note. There is an ongoing investigation, but we don't know what's going to happen.
And one thing we have learned, though, is we know where that material, wherever it came from, that went to Lawrence, Mass. It shouldn't have been there, but we do know where it is now.
We do. Well, as of the last time I spoke with Brady Sullivan, which was about a week or two ago they said that under the supervision of MassDEP, they took this stuff that was in the parking lot, they bottled it up in 55-gallon drums, and it's still on site in Pacific Mills. Now, if you're going to dispose of this stuff properly, there are channels that it has to be done. It's expensive. It's got a lot of the stuff goes to Ohio. what we do know is it should not have been where it was. We just don't know how it got there yet.
That's NHPR's Jack Rodolico. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we take a look at more news of the week, including an update on PFOA in southern New Hampshire. Join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests for the hour, Casey McDermott, digital reporter for NHPR, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of NH Political Capital, and Trent Spinner, executive editor for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Political watchers have been parsing through the latest campaign finance reports. Dean, let's start with the first district representative, Frank Ginta, and we'll just set some context here. The latest WMUR Granite State poll had some interesting results in the dynamics of that race.
Yeah, you know, Frank Ginta has been under a lot of pressure in recent months, given that the Federal Election Commission said that he broke the law in 2010 with a $355,000 either a donation or a loan from his parents that he has been forced to pay back. And we've all been kind of wondering what kind of an impact it was going to have on his fundraising. And as you mentioned, this new poll came out and, you know, not particularly good news for him. And only 4% of people surveyed said they would definitely vote for him. However, those who said they definitely will not vote for him actually dropped from 56% to 46%. So I guess that's progress, and his favorability ticked up from minus 27 to minus 22. So I guess he would consider that to be progress. You know, he raised about $97,000 in the last quarter. You know, if he were to face Carol Shea Porter, his kind of opponent multiple times now, she's raised three times that amount. So he's going to, you know, it's got a bit of a challenge ahead of him. You know, we've sort of wondered whether he was going to stick it out. He has said he's running. Fundraising has been always been kind of uneven for him, and now he has this added FEC kind of stigma attached to his candidacy. And you remember back when it broke, we had a number of high-profile Republicans in the state, including Kelly Ayotte, I believe, saying that he should step aside or not run for re-election at a minimum. But he's going ahead with it right now. The other two candidates, Republicans in that first district, Rich Ashew, who just announced the former BAE government affairs person, has not reported any money yet. He just got into the race. And Pam Tucker, who's a Republican representative, raised about $100,000. $25,000 of that was a personal loan. So, you know, there's some fundraising going on, but the big question had been all along, how would Ginta do?
And that's the ongoing question. I believe Trenta, the Union Leader, reported that Rich Ashew had said to, I think it was reporter Dan Tuohy, that he had about $100,000 raised since he made his announcement a few weeks back. But Dan Tuohy also reported on another wrinkle in the ongoing Ginta finance issue. I'll just let you explain it, because I don't think I could parse my way through it.
Sure. And a lot of people get confused here, so I'm going to just try and kind of lay it out from the beginning. Back in 2010, Frank Ginta took an illegal loan from his parents. This money showed up on his federal disclosures. He said, oh, you know, I forgot that I had a bank account. We forgot that this bank account had, I think it was $355,000 in it. And a lot of people at the time, including NHPR, did some reporting to say, how do you forget you have a $355,000 bank account? So the people complained. His opponents in the primary in 2010 complained to the Federal Election Commission. They launched a five-year investigation, and last year they levied the largest fine in recent history on him, saying that he broke federal law by taking an illegal campaign contribution. And they said, Congressman Ginta, you have to pay back this $355,000 on top of the fine.
And he had a year to do that as part of the settlement, right?
That's right. No, he had to repay, he had to pay the fine immediately, and then, yeah, there was
and then
some,
repay the loan.
Yes.
Right.
And so there was a check that he cut for $355,000. Now, here's where the wrinkle comes in. Between 2010 and 2015, before he was fined and you know, found to be acting illegally, he already paid back $81,500. So the question is, if you already paid back $81,500 of 355. And then after the FEC finding that you acted illegally, you paid back the $355,000. Where did that $81,500 go? And where is that money now? And if you paid it to yourself, did you pay income taxes on it? If you gave it back to your parents, did they pay taxes on it? And what we heard from the Ginta campaign, I mean, this was a lot of work, right, going through and finding all of these loan repayments in federal disclosures. And what we heard from the Ginta campaign was that the FEC is aware of it and that they're currently working on it. Basically, they say there's nothing to see here and that we're going to report this in our upcoming quarterly reports. And so we're going to be watching for that.
There's always another wrinkle coming down the pike when it comes to campaign finances in this
state.
That's
right.
On a different campaign finance note, Dean, a lot of people – I certainly got a lot of press releases this week both from and about the candidates in the U.S. Senate race, Maggie Hassan, the Democratic challenger to Republican incumbent Kelly Ayotte, and each one trying to – sort of say, I'm the one who's positioned in this race, but yes, I could still use some cash.
Yeah, I think they've each raised individually something in the most recent quarter or something like $2.25 million apiece, something roughly like that. But you got to keep in mind, Kelly Ayotte has been raising money ever since she got into the Senate in 2010. So I think she actually has raised something more like $6 or $7 million total. We've talked before about how expensive this race is going to be. The Scott Brown, Gene Shaheen race clocked in total funding at about $55 million. That's both the candidates and also the outside money. This time it's probably going to be even larger. We're already seeing some pretty big ad buys on both sides, both for and against each of the candidates on, you know, Planned Parenthood, on the Supreme Court nomination. And there's going to be plenty more money to come in what most people believe is going to be one of the most high-profile Senate races in the country. So, they're both doing some good fundraising. Hassan obviously has got a late start because, Ayotte has had this sort of head start as a sitting member of Congress. But I think, by the time we're done, there's going to be plenty of money to go around, particularly once the outside groups start spending at even a faster clip.
One more political note before we move on to the issue of PFOA. The Republican National Committee, Dean, has been meeting, and a planned challenge to early primary and caucus states didn't materialize at these meetings. So what happened or what didn't happen?
We're all familiar with this battle that pops up not necessarily every 4 years, but sort of with frequent enough regularity that we're all sort of following it. And the question is, whether or not you continue to have these carve outs, these early state exceptions for, Iowa as the first caucus and New Hampshire's the first primary and then South Carolina and Nevada before the regular window opens in March. So, we knew there was going to be a challenge. There was an initial challenge, I think, in January at a quarterly meeting. It was tabled. Steve Dupree, the New Hampshire RNC rep, who's been, involved in defending the primary for many years, along with others, it was the current meetings were just happening now in Florida. And it, as of yet, has still not materialized. Now, it still will likely come up for some sort of a discussion at the convention in Ohio in July. But so far, the actual challenge has not materialized in the way that we've sort of been watching for it to happen.
So the primary issue could come back up in Cleveland.
This is shaping up to be
quite a convention.
It's going to be quite a convention. We are going to send our reporter Dan Tuohy there because we think it's just going to be. I think it's going to be very important. I think that the carve out, I think we'll be okay in terms of the carve out states. I think Dupree did a pretty good job of saving us. It was a congressman from Utah who said, Basically, get rid of New Hampshire and the other carve out states. Dupree tried to get it off the agenda for this meeting, tried to basically say, we don't even need to deal with this. But it was tabled very quickly. So could it come back up at the convention? I think so, but I think they're going to have some other things to talk about.
Well, we have plenty to talk about, even outside of the political races here in New Hampshire, especially regarding the substance known as PFOA. And Casey, the state announced late last week that it would be taking some new steps regarding its both investigation and its public information regarding PFOA. Can you outline a few of those for
us? Yeah. So I think the important thing is that the Department of Health and Human Services says that it's opened up a kind of public inquiry line. So there have been a lot of questions, a lot of concerns about this. So people can call 603-271-9461. And, you know, ask questions of the state about the investigation, ask about kind of, you know, their eligibility in terms of can they get bottled water? Are they going to get tested? Things like that. It's staffed between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m., but it'll return messages according to the state if you happen to call outside of that window. So they also decided to expand kind of the bottled water radius that they're going to be providing beyond the initial kind of zone that they determined for that. They're also going to be doing more blood testing in that area. So this is just all part of, you know, as you said, kind of a continued ongoing response to that contamination there.
And the Department of Environmental Services is reviewing whether other manufacturers in the state are using PFOA. And state agencies, Trent, are hardly the only ones who are working in response to this issue. The Union Leader reported about towns in this affected area banding together. What are they hoping to do?
They're hoping to just share information. These are public officials who, you know, have a duty to represent the people of Merrimack, Litchfield, Bedford, Manchester. And this is a big issue. We're going to be talking about this for a long time. I think there's going to be a lot of money spent, both taxpayer dollars and possibly money from the private sector if someone is found responsible. And, you know, these local officials said we need to band together and form sort of a small group, a working group, to make sure that we don't find some solution in Merrimack and the folks in Bedford don't know about it. Or, you know, we don't apply for some grant in Manchester and people in Litchfield don't know about it. So those are the four towns impacted right now. And they're going to be working together to see if they can, you know, provide some solutions.
And the longer this kind of story stretches out, Dean, the more facets and the more questions start to pop up. I mean, the Nashua Telegraph was reporting this week on residents in that area are starting to ask local food growers, well, are you affected? Is it, you know, where is your well water coming from? And of course, local food buyers are always asking about the source of their food, but this is an entirely different kind of question.
Yeah, these kinds of situations, when they occur, it's almost like pulling a thread. It really influences the entire fabric of the community. And you know, I obviously I'm not an agricultural specialist, but my understanding is there is variation in terms of the extent to which PFOA stays in the food supply. I guess leafy vegetables are more susceptible to it than other kinds of fruits and vegetables. It doesn't stay in cattle, but it can stay in eggs for up to 30 days. So these are concerns, but it all really comes down to the water source. And so my guess is a lot of the sort of agricultural producers in the area are going to check their water supplies to make sure that they're safe.
On a different note, Trent, Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine announced a reorganization and got that underway this week. So what's behind the move and what might it mean for the school and then for some of its employees?
So they're basically reorganizing the medical school up there. And they are, you know, Dartmouth is obviously a big college, and they also have Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital. And so they are – the hospital is affiliated with the school, but it has its own sort of – it's its own company, right? It has its own executive team. And so what they – decided to do was move a lot of the people who are at the school, a lot of the medical professionals who are at the school, move them over to the hospital. So they said that they would be – this impacts almost 300 people. They would be eliminating about 30 jobs, but they hope to bring in some grant money that will help them build up some other jobs in some other areas. So it's basically a pretty big reorganization. They say if you are a patient at Dartmouth Hitchcock or any of the clinics outside of the Lebanon area, you probably won't notice.
We also learned this week, Casey, that the new $20 bill will now feature Harriet Tubman on the front. Andrew Jackson will still be on the 20, just on the back. And there's something of a New Hampshire connection here, right?
Yep. Yeah. So Senator Jean Shaheen, about a year ago, actually started she said she was inspired by kind of a grassroots movement that was calling for a woman to be on the 20. She filed legislation to kind of get the ball rolling on that and has really been kind of, you know, one of the public faces of that movement in Congress. And there was some back and forth because the Treasury initially said that, well, you know, we're set to change the 10, so we think that we could change that, but maybe we're going to hold off on the 20 for now. That was about a year ago. But they have since decided that, no, we're going to go ahead and change the 20 after all. We'll put Harriet Tubman on the front of that. Harriet Tubman won a kind of public poll that was conducted to decide, you know, which kind of historical female figure should go on there. And so needless to say, Senator Shaheen was pretty pleased with that news this week.
And another New England connection, the White House in its response on Twitter to the announcement about Harriet Tubman was pointing to a young girl from Massachusetts who had written in and said, we should have one of the famous American women, including Harriet Tubman, on there. So New England really playing a big role here in the reshaping U.S. currency. Finally, this is a fun story. Get ready to hear a lot more of this sound in New Hampshire. That is the sound of, well, several of them, but there's going to be a new wolfman on the job, Trent, at Clark's Trading Post.
That's right. So I've never been to Clark's Trading Post. I guess I should. I guess I'm not really a New Hampshireite yet. But
you mean you didn't try out to be the new wolfman?
I didn't. A guy from Barrington, though, got the job. Larry, and I don't, I'm not, do you know how to pronounce his last name?
Larry Vigas?
Vigas, okay. He got the job, and this is sort of a fun thing that's been going on since the 70s. And he is, I think, the eighth official wolf, or the ninth official wolfman at Clark's Trading Post, but I wish him well.
This is kind of prestigious post here, Dean. I'm surprised you didn't go for it, too.
The beard's not quite long enough. I'm getting there. It's quite competitive. There were something like eight or nine people who auditioned, and this fellow who got the job has done some acting. He's, I think, been a props master. He teaches a little theater at Boston College. Also done construction. Also played Santa Claus. So he certainly got the look. And it's one of these things where, you know, in the summer he gets to sort of run along the train and scare little kids and act like kind of like a crazy lumberjack. So you know, it's just kind of a fun, you know, sort of kitschy aspect of summers in northern New England.
Here's Larry Vigas talking about his new job as the new Wolfman and how it compares to his winter job of being, as he puts it, the real Santa Claus.
Because as Santa Claus, I have to have teeth and I have to curl my mustache. But as the Wolfman, I don't need no teeth and I can mess up my hair as much as I want.
Those, I think, count as job perks, most definitely. Before we wrap up, just quickly, what stories are each of you going to look at next week? I'll start with you, Trent.
PFOA, we want to see what happens here. It impacts a lot of people, and we want to really make sure that they have the information they need to make good decisions about what to do.
Casey McDermott.
So I'll be keeping tabs on a lot of things for a new weekly news roundup that we're doing online. You can subscribe to that by going to our e-newsletters section at nhpr.org.
And Dean Spiliotis.
Nice. It's all politics at this point. We get the presidential stuff is certainly interesting, but the statewide races have really heated up, so there's plenty to keep track of there.
Well, big thanks to each of you for joining us for the New Hampshire News Roundup today. Dean Spiliotis, Casey McDermott, Trent Spinner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sure.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. We had help this week from Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.